Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. The United States is beginning to emerge from the COVID-19 pandemic as more people are vaccinated and cases are declining. After more than 18 months of life with COVID, many are ready to put the pandemic behind them and move on. Dr. Sandro Galea argues that instead of thinking our work is done, now is the very time we need to take steps to be better prepared for the next pandemic. Dr. Galea is an epidemiologist and professor at Boston University School of Health. His new book, outlining what it will take to be prepared, is titled The Contagion Next Time. Dr. Galea, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So we know that the next pandemic isn't a question of if, but of when. And you point out in your book that COVID-19 was not a worst case scenario. You write if it had been a SARS type virus, it would have been a lot worse. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, what characterized COVID-19 was it was a very infectious virus. But at the same time, the case fatality rate, and the lethality of the virus is actually quite low. Maybe it's 1%, maybe 2%. SARS was probably around 9 to 10%. A virus like MERS was in the 30%. So it's entirely possible that another virus will be much more lethal than COVID-19 was, which of course would be devastating. SARS, we got lucky as a country that we did not have a large outbreak of SARS. Toronto, just over the border in Canada, had a substantial outbreak of SARS. So I do think that it is realistic for us to think there will be another outbreak. And it's important to start thinking now about how we make sure that we handle that one better.
The overreaching message of your book is that while we have made great strides in health in America in the past century, the COVID-19 pandemic has shown us exactly where there's room for improvement. Before we talk about where we need to improve, I'd like you to talk about why we've made great strides in health in America over the last century, because it's likely not for the reasons that most of us would think. So what are the factors that have improved health outcomes over the past century?
Yeah, our improvement in health over the past 1 to 2 centuries is extraordinary. I mean, in 1800, our life expectancy was about 40, and now our life expectancy is about 80. And that was a doubling of life expectancy when life expectancy had been roughly the same for thousands of years. And of course, the reason we got there was because we started building healthier cities. We started washing our hands. We started eating safe food. The air became cleaner. We actually started to have opportunities to exercise. All of that is what made for this incredible improvement in our lives. We started living longer, healthier lives. We tend to think that our improvement on health was about medicines, but medicines really only kick in at the extremes of life when we're over age 75. And they do make a difference, but they make a very small difference. Fundamentally, our improvement in health is because we have improved the world around us. It's a world that generates health. It's a world which is safer. We die less from violence. We've made our cars safer. We have made what we eat safer. We have made all our interactions better and healthier. And that is what improved their health. And of course, that is also where we fall short, where we can be better.
In the book, you write about the foundational forces of health, the part of our lives in society that impact our health the most, and therefore are what we should focus on in order to improve everyone's health. Can you tell us what they are and why they're important?
Well, in the same breath as I'm saying that we have improved our health dramatically, what do we know when we compare ourselves to other high-income countries is that we have not improved anywhere near as much as we can. I mean, we spend more on health than all other high-income countries, by a lot, by about 30 to 40% more. But at the same time, all our other peer countries, essentially high-income countries, they all have longer life expectancies and they live longer, healthier lives than we do. And the question is, why is that? Well, it's not because we're not investing, because we're investing a lot, as I just said, but we keep investing in medicines and treatment. We keep investing in making sure that we have the capacity to treat ourselves once we get sick. We're not investing in keeping ourselves healthy. Now, how do we make sure we do that? Well, we do that by investing in safe housing. We do that by making sure everybody has livable wages. We do that by making sure everybody lives in safe neighborhoods. We do that by making sure our air is clean, our water is safe to drink, our food is safe to eat. Those are the areas that we have not invested in enough. And in fact, the areas we have invested in, which is treatments and medicines, we're doing very well. Vaccines is a perfect example of that. They emerge from decades of investment in vaccine platforms, resulting in this extraordinary success of vaccines in a short time in COVID-19. That reflects that when we invest, we do well. What we are underinvesting in is the structures that build a healthier world, and that's where we can do much better.
Yeah, I'd love for you to talk a little bit more about the importance of housing in positive health outcomes, because as you detail in the book, housing can also be the cause of poor health outcomes.
Yes, an infectious outbreak is a good example of why housing is a problem, because if a virus is transmitted by person-to-person contact, the if you have crowding and in housing, you are more likely to transmit the virus to one another. So we've seen this throughout this pandemic, that people who live in crowded houses, they're much more likely to actually have transmission of the virus and the higher rates of then caseness of COVID-19, which of course stands to reason. Then the question becomes, well, why is it that some people live in more crowded housing than others? That of course reflects economic resources, ability to buy houses that are more spacious and as a result, safer during the pandemic. And one can trace that back to historical time. Is it, why is it that some of us are able to buy better houses than others? Well, that reflects people who have been in a position of having wealth and wealth that allows one to accumulate over generations to buy better houses, which then becomes greater risk or less risk of COVID. So something like housing has been one of the differentiators about why some groups in our society have been at higher risk of COVID than others. And you can trace that back, for example, to efforts like redlining, which historically were efforts that prevented African-American families from owning homes, which then becomes less wealth, becomes worse housing, becomes greater risk of getting the virus, which becomes what we saw in this context of COVID-19, where Black Americans were twice as likely to die from COVID-19 as white Americans. So really, it is these fundamental social and economic conditions that are shaped over historical time that translate into the very real results that happened during COVID-19.
In the U.S., we tend to believe our health outcomes are largely determined by personal choice rather than forces out of our control. What has caused us to think about health in this way, and why is it misguided?
Yeah, it's a great question. I suppose the best way to answer that is perhaps by metaphor and story, and we can look at something like motor vehicle accidents, car accidents. So in the past 100 years, we have reduced our chance of dying from a car accident by 200-fold. That's a huge drop, 200-fold. Now, how did we do that? Is it because drivers are better drivers? Well, not really. I mean, drivers have always been terrible and they will always be terrible. We've done that because of seatbelts and airbags and shatterproof glass and laws to make sure that people are not driving when they're under the influence of alcohol. So is there personal choice? Of course, there's personal choice. Ultimately, you're still getting in your car, and ultimately a good driver is still less likely to get in a car accident than a bad driver. But what we've done is we have created the conditions that all drivers are safer, whether they're good drivers or bad drivers. And that's how to think about choice. There will always be choice. There will always be autonomy. So there will I will always have a choice to get up and exercise or not. However, if I live in a neighborhood that's safe, I can exercise the choice by exercising. But if I live in a neighborhood that's unsafe, it doesn't matter what I want to do, I still can't go outside and exercise. So the choice is an element that intersects with the world around us. And what we've learned over decades of research is that we as humans need to create for ourselves the environment that maximally promotes our health, that allows us and encourages us and nudges us to make healthy choices. Ultimately, we always will have autonomy to choose and not to choose, but that autonomy exists within a larger framework that can make us healthy or not.
We have an email question. Is there a country whose model for investments in better health outcomes is one we can look to as we try to make those changes in the U.S.?
Yeah, it's a terrific question. And the answer to that is there are any number of countries that have elements that I think are emulable. And I'm always hesitant to name one country simply because I think there are particular cultural features to this country that are remarkable and very much distinctive to the U.S. And I'm not sure that the U.S. should try, for example, to become Sweden. I don't think that would be right. I think we should say there are things that we can learn from Sweden, from the UK, from Colombia, from Ecuador, and adapt them to what is culturally relevant here.
Our number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. You write in the book that in our country, we tend to marginalize those with poor health, for example, obesity, behavioral disorders, addiction, et cetera. How does this marginalization exacerbate poor health outcomes?
Perhaps the best illustration of that, of course, is in the context of an infectious disease pandemic like COVID-19. Because in absent infectious disease pandemic, I think it's sometimes too easy to say, well, people with poor health are over there and they're not my concern. I can be charitable and I can care about them, but they're not my concern. Well, with an infectious disease outbreak, we realize that if you have COVID, I have a greater risk of having COVID, that we have a very clear incentive to make sure that none of us have COVID, because anyone having COVID is a greater risk for the rest of us to have COVID. So I think this is a teachable moment where we recognize that we should not be marginalizing anybody with poor health. And as a result, we have a collective responsibility to create the conditions that we can all be healthy. So let's take a concrete example. Obesity in this country has increased by about threefold in the past 30 years. Now, why did that happen? Is it because that we have changed our eating patterns? Well, not really so much. The reason that's happened is because we have much wider availability of calorie-dense, nutrient-poor foods. We could be eating the same way, only just now we're gaining more weight. Now, we can say, well, people who are not careful, it's their problem. But no, the way to look at this is we are in this together. We have our shared humanity that should unite our interest in making sure that we are all as healthy as possible. And we should then look at our food supply to say, how can we have the best possible food supply that we can all have healthy weight so that we can reduce the burden of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, et cetera.
Is the interplay of racial and economic inequality with human health something that is often studied and discussed in the public health world?
It is, and it is increasingly so. And in some respects, it's probably not discussed enough and not studied enough. We saw this play out in a really stark and heartbreaking way, for example, around COVID. I already alluded to the fact that Black Americans were twice as likely to die from COVID than white Americans. And the question is, why is that? Well, that's for two reasons. Reason A is that people who are working in lower wage jobs, which tend to be disproportionately people of color in this country, were less able to work remotely. So as a result, they were more exposed to risk of getting COVID and a greater prevalence of the disease. The second reason is that COVID affected more severely people with underlying other diseases, things like diabetes and hypertension. And people of color, Black Americans in particular, have historically in this country had higher burden of those diseases because of a history of marginalization, history of disadvantage. So as a result, Black Americans were more likely to get COVID and get severe COVID, resulting in greater death from COVID. Like that is reflects deep racial and social injustice. That reflects decades and centuries of marginalization, going back to the institutions of Jim Crow and slavery. So it is actually impossible to understand COVID, to understand the how COVID played out without understanding racial, social, and economic justice. And those become part of what we need to think about when we think about public health.
Yeah. In the book, you devote chapters to why empathy and compassion are necessary characteristics that decision makers and average citizens must have in order to ensure better health for everyone. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I try to make a distinction between empathy and compassion in the book. And the distinction is as follows. So that empathy says, I would like you to be healthy because I can see the world through your eyes. And I see why you might be suffering. And therefore, I would like you to make it better. Well, compassion says, I don't need to be able to see the world through your eyes. I actually don't want you to be suffering because we are united by our shared humanity, because we are both people and people should care that everybody else is healthy. Now, why does compassion matter? Compassion matters because I think empathy is limited. In truth, there are only so many people whose eyes I can see through because I really could not understand the experiences, the lived experience of many others. Compassion says that we should do everything we can to make sure that all humans are as healthy as possible. Now, that matters. Because when you have compassion, you realize that we cannot allow the market to dictate who can buy health and who cannot. Because fundamentally, compassion says, if I want you to be as healthy as possible, if I see that as a shared value, then I should make an effort to make sure that you have access to what makes you healthy, whether you can afford it or not. And it elevates health above a good that can be bought and sold. And that, of course, is a dramatic difference in how we see health right now. But I suppose the argument I'm making is twofold. Number one, this should be a value that we ascribe. This should be a value that we should want to have in our society. And second, COVID is, again, to use the term, a teachable moment, because we have seen in COVID that absent that value, we're going to have unnecessarily high rates of the virus. And if anybody has a necessarily high rate of virus, you yourself may have an unnecessarily greater risk of getting the virus. That the infectious disease unites us together in a way that brings these issues to the fore, and we cannot avoid them anymore. And what I'm hoping to do with the book is to say, this is a moment that transforms how we think about health. And we recognize that our health is linked. Your health and my health are interconnected. And in order for me to be healthy, I want you to be healthy. And I think that's the right thing to do scientifically and the right thing to do morally. Mm.
Many who identify as progressive or liberal might consider themselves compassionate and empathetic to others, particularly those in marginalized groups, but they might not be ready to extend compassion or empathy to people on the other side of the political aisle or those who refuse to be vaccinated or wear a mask. What are your thoughts on why it's important to extend empathy toward everyone, particularly those with whom you don't agree, and not give in to our tendency to judge others?
Yeah, you know, as you asked that question, I just wish I could disagree with you, but I don't, because I think you're absolutely right. I think we have seen in the past maybe 5-6 years in this country, this enormous division and this enormous, as you correctly say, I think lack of compassion to people who disagree with us. And I think that is corrosive and simply wrong. I think fundamentally, compassion should extend to everybody, particularly those we disagree with. You know, it's easy to be compassionate with people who agree with you, people who are like you. Compassion, its true test is people who disagree with you. I feel like our politics have become so divisive that you hear things like this. Sometimes you hear people say, particularly in sort of progressive liberal circles, well, I can't understand how somebody would not want to get vaccinated. Well, my challenge to that is, if you cannot understand how somebody could not get vaccinated, doesn't want to get vaccinated, since that's about 30% of the country, then you're not thinking hard enough. It is important that we can understand people on either side of this of a discussion, so that we can actually try to help people arrive at the right decision for their health. So I actually think compassion should extend to everybody, people who want to get vaccinated, people who do not, so we can have the conversation to get to a place, which I think is the right scientific place, that these vaccines are safe, efficacious, and important for all of us to take. But fundamentally, we're not going to have that by walling off other people. We're going to have that by having a conversation. A colleague of mine says the phrase that if we disagree, it means we haven't talked long enough. And I like that. I actually think it means that we should be talking more and talking to everybody, particularly people we disagree with.
You write quite a bit in the book about how those in the medical profession, including those overseeing our nation's response to the pandemic, need to have more humility as new information and data on diseases change and evolve. So tell us more about how you come to think about this.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges that we've seen in the pandemic is in perhaps an overabundance of false confidence, of what I've called in other places epistemic arrogance, that we are overstate how much we know and the certitude with which we know it, when in fact there's been a lot that we don't know. And I think that's a real problem, because people can see right through when one is pretending to know, when in fact there's a lot we don't know. And I cannot help but feel that a fair bit of the public reluctance to accept wisdom as being explained, discussed by authorities, has come from seeing through the arrogance, seeing through the pretense of knowing, when in fact there are things we don't know. In fact, there's good science on this that says the public is able to handle it if you say you don't know. I think people are able to handle it when you say you don't know. And I think in science, this has been a mistake for the past almost 2 years of the pandemic, that we have not said enough, we do not know. And I suppose I'm trying to encourage us to say when we don't know, because I think it's okay to say we do not know. And I think in the long term, it builds trust. You know, one of the challenges we've had with the vaccine has been this lack of trust. And I'm often asked, well, how do we build trust in the vaccine right now? To which my answer is, you don't. You actually cannot build trust in the short term. You build trust in the long term. And you build trust in the long term by having the trust in the scientific establishment that will tell you when it does not know, so that when it does know, as we know now, that these vaccines are safe and efficacious, then people will trust and actually go ahead and get vaccinated.
During a crisis, we're more likely to take a bold action, but once the crisis passes, we often revert to old ways. For example, during the height of the pandemic, the government sent stimulus checks to everyone, yet the idea of cash payments from the government was considered radical just before the start of the pandemic. What are your thoughts on how we maintain a sense of urgency once the crisis has ended?
Yeah, well, I suppose that's why I wrote the book, is to try to keep this conversation going. You know, I use the metaphor in the book of a ship in a storm, and I use the metaphor that if you have a hole in the hull of your ship, you don't fix that hole while you're going through the storm. You fix that hole when the storm is subsided, the ship is on calm water, or you can get the ship off water onto dry docks. And I feel the problem we have sometimes is you have a hole in the hull, you go into a storm and you say, my goodness, this is terrible. Then we get to calm water and you're like, ah, it's not a big deal. It's okay, we can get by. What I'm trying to do is to say, once the storm subsides, let's make sure we fix the hole in the ship's hull. And the hole in the ship's hull here is how we have handled our health. The hole here is that we have underinvested in a world that makes us healthy. We are unnecessarily sick, and as a result, unnecessarily vulnerable to a pandemic like this. We have underinvested in our public health system. As a result, we could not respond to a virus like this. We have unnecessary divisions where we have people who are marginalized and disadvantaged, who carry a greater burden of disease and are vulnerable, disproportionately vulnerable to a virus like this. All of these things we should tend to before the next pandemic. I'm not making an argument against investing also in better vaccine technology, better surveillance technology. We should also do that. But if we did only that, that's not going to be sufficient.
In the book, you use the example of gay marriage to demonstrate how our societal views can change over time. Do you think the willingness of Americans to address the social and racial justice issues that contribute to poverty and poor health will become more mainstream over time, or does the growing polarization of our country suggest it's farther away?
Yeah, I'm leaning solidly into hope and optimism here, and I think it will change. You know, when I have conversations like this, sometimes I find people have two poles of reactions to it. One pole is people say everything you're saying is obvious. Another pole is people saying everything you're saying is radical. Well, I don't think it's radical or obvious. I think it's somewhere in the middle. What I think I'm doing is I'm putting forward ideas that, to my mind, build on reason and logic, and that will eventually be taken up and become mainstream. I think I use gay marriage as a good example, and that 50 years ago, it was radical to think that gay marriage would become as accepted, as commonplace as it is today, and of course, legally sanctioned and all that. And then it happened. And how did that happen? Well, it happened through enough people advancing the argument, through enough experience with friends and colleagues and brothers and sisters who are in happy, stable gay marriages, and through a societal shift that says, this is norm, this is a better way to be, this is the way life should be, this is the way a compassionate world should be built. And I argue that the points I'm making here are also that. These are points about this is how life should be, this is the way a more compassionate world should be, one where there is no differential risk of poor health just because of the color of your skin, just because you happen to be born on the wrong side of the tracks, where when a pandemic happens, we actually have the tools to protect people fairly and evenly from getting the virus, and where the virus is not disproportionately hitting particular groups in our society that have been marginalized for decades and centuries. That is the kind of world we should build. And I would argue that X years from now, we should be in a place where we say, well, this is just how it is. This is the right way to build a world.
As an epidemiologist, was there anything that surprised you about the way the pandemic unfolded in the U.S.?
I think there were particular elements of viral dynamics that we did not understand, and it was just something I never faced, this virus, with the number of waves and then the mutations with the variants and all that. I mean, that is all biologically new and we were learning. But I think leaving that aside, in March of 2020, several of us wrote pieces that pointed out what was going to happen, that pointed out how the virus was going to come, how it's going to affect some groups more than others. And unfortunately, all that was borne out. And I think the fact that all that was borne out is heartbreaking, in that we knew that particular groups are going to be affected more than others, and we still could not prevent that. And we should not have that happen again, because we know it will happen again with the next pandemic, and we should act now so that it does not happen that way.
Yeah. Did the COVID-19 pandemic prompt you to write the book, or was the topic something that you had been thinking about for a while?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, in some respects, the underlying issues are things I've been thinking about for a while, and I've written previous books around them. And I think the pandemic catalyzed them and brought them to the surface. Somebody said when they read the book, said, well, you know, the first half of the book isn't really about COVID. And that's correct. The first half of the book really lays the ground and says, this is how the world is structured. This is how our health is generated. COVID, of course, just took all that and elevated, made it sharper, made it clearer. And what I'm hoping to do is to use the COVID moment to illuminate these points that we should be dealing with, no matter what. We should have been dealing with these points whether COVID happened or not. But with COVID, surely we're now much more alert. I'll go back to the ship and the hole in the hull example. If you have a ship and you have a hole in the hull, you should fix it whether you're in a storm or not. Now, when you're in a storm, it sharpens the mind and says, well, geez, I better fix that because I might sink the ship next time I'm in a storm. We are now going through the storm with this hole in the hull, and we should make sure we fix that as soon as the storm is over.
So if there's one thing that you hope readers take away from the book, what is it?
I think my hope is that we recognize that the consequences of pandemics like this are determined very much by social economic decisions that we've made for decades and for centuries, and that this pandemic, which was tragic, truly tragic, 700,000 Americans dying, and you know the number is just a big number, and it's hard to wrap one's brain around. That's 700,000 mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, lovers, uncles, aunts. These are people in our world around us. That should not happen again. And if we're serious about that not happening again, we need to tend to the underlying structural, economic, and social challenges that characterize our world. It's the right thing to do, and it's the smart thing to do if we want to be protected from the next pandemic.
Dr. Sandro Galea, an epidemiologist and professor at Boston University School of Health, will have more information about his book, The Contagion, next time at our website, capeandislands.org. Dr. Galea, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up after break, we talk with a physician at the Community Health Center about how the pandemic impacted the more vulnerable members of the community. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing how the pandemic impacted the most vulnerable in our community and how we can be better prepared for the next pandemic by improving health outcomes for all. Joining us is the Chief Transformation Officer at the Community Health Center, Dr. Munir Ahmed. Welcome. Good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mindy.
All right, so first we should mention that the Community Health Center is formerly the Community Health Center of Cape Cod, located in Mashpee. So a little bit of a name change, and why the name change?
It's just basically, first of all, thank you for doing this. The reason for it, we just want to differentiate between, because a lot of people getting confused with Cape Cod Healthcare and with the community health. So just to differentiate and have a separate identity.
Yeah. And your title is Transformation Officer. So what does that entail? And do you see patients?
Yes. Let me give you like the background of it. I joined Community Health Center about 2 years ago, and that's the time when we were hit with COVID. I think January 2020. So I joined them as a Chief Transformation Officer to bring some innovation to the practice and technology. And make some changes as far as the way we manage patients. but with COVID-19, we just jumped into the technology. And I think I am really proud of this organization because we started doing these televisits, virtual visits, because initially, as you're aware of that, with the COVID-19, we were not able to connect with the patients right away because there's a fear from the patients, from the healthcare workers. So how are we going to see our patients? So that televisit, virtual visits were a godsend, and that helped our patients, and we continue the care throughout that time frame. And in case we were the only one at that time that we were doing it really well with virtual visits and providing the care. And so that's what my one objective throughout those 2 years, to bring the technology and making sure we will provide the care to especially those populations who are suffering. They are not getting the outreach. So we created also shared visits for people who have diabetes, who have high blood pressure, who have obesity, to counter those things. And we connect them through, again, virtual, so we don't have to bring them in the office. So virtually we connect with these people to have an impact overall, as Dr. Galea was describing, that these communities where we are seeing more obesity, more other chronic illnesses, and it's COVID-19 hitting them really hard. And how we have an impact on those people making a lifestyle change.
So tell us more about the population that you serve.
So it's a mix of, mixture of everything. Like, elderly people from young people, so it's a mix of different race, different ethnicity, different sexual orientations. So another part for the community health is the medical home. And so in the one roof, you provide the care, like, you know, the dental, the primary care, the behavior health, women's health, pharmacy is right there, ophthalmology is there. So especially people who have transportation issues, and we cannot just basically, you know, tell the patients, okay, go see that doctor, see that person. So you are in a one place getting all the care. That's the wonderful part of the community center. That's a medical home.
Yeah. So you were doing that. The community health center was doing that well before COVID, kind of bringing everything under one roof, which has been extremely beneficial, especially for those who have some mental health issues, to have all of that under one roof. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Did you have patients who didn't have internet or devices to connect to the center for care? If so, how did you provide for those patients?
So we connect them with the phone. Some of them, like, they don't have, like, you know, the internet or virtually, we cannot. So we connect them with the phone. So that's the only mode of communication with those patients. And some of them we also provide them who does not have any cell phone services. So we provide them phones. Mm-hmm. So they will have an access for to communicate with their providers.
Yeah. Would you share any of the individual stories of your patients and how they fared during the pandemic? I imagine you had, people who lost their jobs, people who are struggling with stable housing or food insecurity.
There are many, many of hundreds of stories, but few of them, especially like one of the female patients who was suffering from substance use disorder and lost the house and basically, you know, homeless. So our chronic care team get involved with that patient and hook her with the addiction program and also get her housing. And now this patient get the housing and down the road she got the job, and now she is a part of the community helping other people. So this is how it works kudos for our chronic care team. They are involved so much with these patients that they provide the care and provide them, assistance where they needed it. And as we were discussing with Dr. Galea, the housing is a huge issue. And especially on the Cape, it's a huge issue. That because not just COVID, but before the COVID, it was a problem. But now with the COVID, is double or triple the issue right now, because they don't have the housing, they don't have the food, they don't have transportation. So we are trying to help these communities.
Yeah. So we know that loss of a job, unstable housing, or food insecurity can cause stress, major stress.
Yes.
And stress can lead to all sorts of negative health outcomes. Can you talk about how you saw patients' health, individuals' health suffer because of the pandemic, even if they didn't get COVID?
Definitely. So this is another beauty of this organization, that we have a behavioral health team. By doing that, a lot of people coming in, even they don't have the COVID, as you said, they either their family member or in the community, they are exposed to that part, and that's just stressing their level. It's just stressing their level by just going to their family member, that I don't want to make my father or my grandmother sick, I don't want to go there. That's stressing them for the last 6 months or 1 year, they haven't seen their family. So this is a huge factor, and I think with the behavioral therapy and with the talking to our patients to just decompress that anxiety, because that anxiety and stress leads to other things, medical problems.
Mm-hmm. So what trends have you seen since the start of the pandemic in terms of numbers of people seeking treatment for depression, anxiety, or substance use disorder?
It increased tenfold. It increased, so we are seeing a lot of people having, behavioral health and also addiction issues along with that. Because again, as you know, the stress and all those things, you know, create, if somebody has addiction issue, they will get more involved in addiction.
So what kinds of supports are available from the Community Health Center to treat behavioral health issues and substance use disorders? I'm thinking, you know, we hear a lot from mental health providers that they're booked. They can't take any new patients, and there's so many people seeking help. Are you able to meet that demand, and what are your people doing?
Yes. So again, like, everybody's trying their level best right now, right? So we are trying to accommodate as many as we can. Then if we cannot, then we dissipate those people in the community and find other therapists. But we don't let them go in that part, because even if they don't have a behavioral, then they will be seeing their own providers more frequently. Because, you know, a lot of time, like, primary care doctors see their patients on a yearly basis. At community health center, the primary care doctor will be seeing their patients maybe weekly basis in those conditions. Mm-hmm. So that provides the care continuously to make sure that they have a tap on them.
Yeah. We're talking about how the pandemic impacted the more vulnerable members of the community. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing how the pandemic impacted the most vulnerable in our community and how we can be better prepared for the next pandemic by improving healthcare for all. With us is Chief Transformation Officer at the Community Health Center, Dr. Munir Ahmed. You know, we're talking a little bit about the need and meeting that. And I'm wondering, are you finding that you're able to keep up with the demand as we're seeing more people seeking help? And is there a need for more providers in certain areas?
Definitely. So since I joined, we add additional five primary care doctors and also keep hiring more docs and always looking for it. If you, Mindy, if you have a few doctors, send it our way. So we definitely, especially, it's not just community health. On the Cape itself, we are desperate in need of primary care docs, because there's always a need, and there are, you know, a lot of patients, they don't have primary care docs. Yeah. So we are trying to supplement that part. But again, as I said, we need more primary care docs in the community.
As we discussed with Dr. Galea, many of us make assumptions about people with poor health or those who are out of work or homeless. And those assumptions often lead to marginalization of people. Do you see examples of people being marginalized in our community because of circumstances out of their control?
I don't see that part at the community health because there's so much compassion and empathy towards our populations that I don't see that part at all, that we marginalize anybody, you know?
Yeah. So, how is the Community Health Center poised to help patients with the other factors that contribute to poor health outcomes, such as, you know, housing, economic instability, or food insecurity? Are you able to help people with that?
Oh yeah, definitely. So as I give you that example, that our chronic care team is basically providing the if somebody is in need for housing, or if somebody is basically for the need for the food, and always basically we partners with the health department, fire department, and even if we have to do some home visits, we go to the home, like people who cannot, you know, transport, or they don't have any transportation. So you do home visits on those patients and provide them that, you know, make sure that they have the means to take care of themselves. So the answer to your question, yes, we do.
One of Dr. Galea's points is that none of us have the security of good health unless all of us have good health. As you look at the overall health of this community, where do you see the biggest need for improvement? Is it livable wages? Is it safe and stable housing? What do you see?
So quite frankly, for me, like on the Cape right now, it's a...
You muted yourself, Dr. Ahmed. Yeah, there you go. You are on mute. Go ahead.
So housing is a main issue on the Cape. And of course, like with the with the financial impact, a lot of people, they don't have, you know, like a standard of like wages. So they cannot take care of themselves. They cannot afford to rent. They cannot afford a house. So I personally think the housing is a huge, huge issue. Is that, like, I'm going to give you an example of one of our patient that because of he does not have any house, does not have any transportation. So he's having really hard time to come to the visits or you know, so we are arranging those visits by giving him Uber or a taxi voucher and those kind of things to bring him to the office. So just imagine that becoming so harder for our patients to even to get the normal care.
What are some of the ways individuals and the community can step up efforts to improve the health and well-being of our neighbors? And, you know, is writing a check enough? You know, what else can you do?
I think that's one of the factors. Writing a check is important, yeah. Right? But I think to communicate and take care of each other, like as you said, neighbors, like making sure your neighbor is basically how they are doing. So I think like we can go on our old phase that where everyone is taking care of each other in the neighborhood. So that's what we need to take care of our own needs, regardless of race, regardless of who they are, doesn't matter. It's the matter of basic humanity. So because I think at some stage we lose that part, and I think we need to connect with that humanity part. Checks will help, but if there is no humanity, check not going to do anything.
Not to do anything, yeah. There's been a lot of misinformation, especially around the COVID vaccine, and I imagine you hear some of this from your patients. What are some of the common misconceptions that people have about the vaccine?
Yeah, I think like it's a combination. People are reading too much on the web, and there's so much misinformation out there that they some of them think that the government is putting a chip in their body and we monitoring them. And some people think that they, you know, they're not gonna get pregnant because of the vaccine. So there are a lot of misconception in that regard. So our job as a physicians or as a medical health workers, making sure educate our people and give them the information that they need, you know. But there will be people that they again have misconception, and you respect that part. Because you, as Dr. Gelly also, you know, saying about it, that you need the compassion towards those people too.
Yeah. Go ahead. Are you finding people who were initially hesitant to get the vaccine are more comfortable now that we're almost a year into vaccinations and there haven't been a lot of these negative health outcomes associated with it?
Yeah, I'm going to give you an example of this. So we did door-to-door policy, like going to the door-to-door, especially in Asian population, there are restaurants. And so finally, one person showed up. Initially, there was hesitancy from them. And one person showed up for the vaccine. And after they have a good experience, they went back and they bring a lot of their friends and family to get vaccinated. So again, as I said, there is a hesitancy, but with a certain education, people are coming back and getting vaccines.
5 to 11-year-olds are now eligible for the COVID vaccine. Does the Community Health Center have a pediatric unit? And if so, are there plans to offer the vaccine to this group of children?
Not at this time, but we do have a family practice, but we don't have a pediatrician, but we have family practice. So some of our providers, they do see, you know, that population, but not many.
Yeah. So how are you and your staff at the Community Health Center holding up 18 months into this pandemic? You know, the need has grown a lot. You've got a lot of different, you know, things you're dealing with. How are you and the staff holding up?
So I think like we, every like, you know, every one of us, like in the community, not just with the community health, everybody's stressed out. It's not basically just the people in the healthcare business, they are more stressed out. So what we are doing, we are basically making sure that they are communicating with each other, helping each other, and we are there for them, especially for the staff. So the support that you provide from the upper and senior management to our staff, that's a huge thing, and getting them involved and always support them. And if any person needs any kind of behavioral health, we provide them. So thank God we didn't get any, anybody needs behavioral health at this time.
Yeah. But do you also have support groups for your patients, though, for who might be needing some extra help in that, you know, dealing with all of this?
Yes, definitely. So we do have like a support system through our psychologists, our social workers. Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. As a public health physician, do you see any silver linings to this pandemic?
In what sense?
No, I mean, any positive, you know, we talk with a lot of, like, in the arts, you know, they expanded a lot of, you know, virtual audience. And I'm thinking, you know, you've got that, is there anything that's been beneficial that you plan to continue when the pandemic is over, maybe?
Definitely. So, as I mentioned, like, basically, the virtual televisit not going to go away, because initially, the plan was to start it and then just gonna fade away, and then we gonna start people, you know, people gonna be bringing them into the office. But my objective is to bring the virtual visits are not gonna go away. So that's the best way of reaching out a lot of population, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's not gonna go away. Shared visits will be you know, on through the virtual, either virtual or in person. Also, through your courtesy, I will mention that we are bringing lifestyle medicine to our organization soon, you know, coming soon. So that will also have a huge, huge impact on our population in respect to the diet, nutrition, stress. So there's a combination of things that with the lifestyle medicine. And we are bringing that to our organizations, and that will have a huge impact. And we're gonna start as a virtual initially, the virtual visits with the patients. And I'm hoping that will have a huge impact on obesity, because if you take away with obesity, and then the cost of healthcare also gonna reduce if you take away one of their medications. By doing lifestyle change, that will have a huge impact on our healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Do you also feel like since the pandemic, communication has improved? You know, are you feeling, reach, because there's so much outreach now, do you feel like communication is better now?
Between patients and us, or between the providers?
Yeah, both, yeah.
Oh, yes, definitely. I think we are communicating more. We are always in touch with our patients, and now some of the patients who can able to use the portal, they can connect and send messages to us all the time. And so communication is better. Yes, good. Definitely.
Dr. Munir Ahmed is Chief Transformation Officer at the Community Health Center, formerly the Community Health Center of Cape Cod. Dr. Ahmed, thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you, Mindy. Thanks a lot.
And we'll have links at our website with more information, capeandislands.org. I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.